Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 172. It's Monday, August 1st. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we live in a nation where health care is criminalized. I'm talking about the recent overturning of Roe versus Wade, and this is not entirely new territory, but this is a massive quantum leap into that territory, and it's going to be complicated. So let's see a little bit of some of the effects. Texas has been kind of leading the way. First up, a story from the Houston Chronicle. Risk of serious pregnancy complications has doubled since Texas abortion ban, study finds. Pregnant patients at two Dallas hospitals faced almost double the risk of serious health complications after the state's abortion restrictions took effect and caused doctors to delay care until their lives were in immediate danger, a new study shows. Researchers at Parkland Health and UT Southwestern Medical Center found that the Texas laws, which create criminal and civil liability for doctors who perform abortions beyond about 6 weeks gestation, led to uncertainty about when doctors are legally able to end a pregnancy and profoundly affected their patients. Delayed treatment due to the abortion laws led 57% of patients to experience serious health complications, nearly double the number of complications experienced by patients in other states who were able to get immediate abortions. Although limited by sample size, our findings offer a glimpse into the possible not-so-distant future, the study's authors concluded. The future is here. Well, Ohio made some of the first big news nationally when it had a 10-year-old who was raped who had to go out of state to get an abortion. But how common or uncommon is that? This from ABC News. Abortion in young girls is not uncommon, experts say. According to the Guttmacher Institute, a reproductive health policy research organization, there were 4,460 pregnancies among people age 14 and younger in 2017. The Institute estimates that around half of those pregnancies, 1,960, ended in abortion. An abortion provider in Indiana told ABC News in an interview that about half or so of patients who are minors report that their pregnancies were as a result of rape. But even before the Supreme Court decision, experts said minors face more barriers to abortions than adults. Some states, including Indiana, have laws requiring minors, generally people under the age of 18, to get legal consent from their parents to get an abortion, or go through a judicial bypass and get a judge to sign off on getting their procedure. According to Guttmacher, 36 states require parental involvement, either parental consent or parental notification, in a minor's decision to get an abortion, and 21 states require parental consent. The system is so challenging to navigate, and to try to do so as a minor who can't drive themselves, who can't pay for things themselves because they're too young to legally work, and yet they're having to face these kinds of major healthcare decisions on their own. It's so tragic to see. And of course, when a minor is raped by somebody close to them, that can exponentially increase the complications of a girl seeking help in getting an abortion. Okay, well, next up, I want to do some COVID-19 stories. How many lives could a fall COVID-19 booster campaign save for the United States? A new Commonwealth Fund study finds that an aggressive fall COVID-19 booster vaccination campaign could save 160,000 lives and avert $109 billion in medical costs. But policymakers must act first. A potential fall surge in COVID-19 infections could cause up to 1,500 deaths a day unless the pace of vaccinations picks up dramatically. An aggressive booster campaign could turn the situation around. We estimate that an early fall booster vaccination campaign that reaches coverage similar to the 2020-2021 influenza vaccination would prevent nearly 102,000 deaths, more than a million hospitalizations, and generate savings of $63 billion associated with direct medical costs by the end of March 2023 compared to the baseline. An even more successful campaign, which results in 80% of eligible U.S. population receiving booster doses, would prevent approximately 160,000 deaths, more than 1.7 million hospitalizations, and avert $109 billion in direct medical costs over the course of the next 8 months, compared with a scenario in which there's an unchanged daily vaccination rate. At booster coverage mirroring the 2020 to 2021 influenza campaign, this translates to $1,241 in savings per dose. In moving from the lower coverage target to the higher, savings would drop to $706 per dose that would be realized. So under both of those scenarios, you're saving between $700 and $1,200 per booster, per vaccination. So still very cost effective. It's been true for a long time in public health that vaccination tends to be one of the most effective public health strategies you can use. Unfortunately, there's a lot of reticence and hesitation out there to get vaccinated. And this is a more of a deep dive into the most newly eligible to get vaccinated, those under five. This from CNN. More than 40% of parents of young kids say they will not get their child a COVID-19 vaccine, survey finds. New survey results published last Tuesday by the Kaiser Family Foundation indicate that 43% of parents of children under 5 in the U.S. say they will not get their child vaccinated against COVID-19, the highest percentage in the year that the Kaiser Family Foundation's Vaccine Monitor Survey has been asking the question. The U.S. FDA authorized COVID-19 vaccinations in children as young as 6 months in mid-June. According to the Kaiser Family Foundation data, only 17% of parents of children between 6 months and 5 years old say their child has been vaccinated or will be as soon as possible. Another 27% say they will wait and see how well the shots work in other kids. And 13% said they will vaccinate their child only if required to do so for school or childcare. Although the percentage of parents unwilling to vaccinate children in this age group is high, it is not much lower than in other age groups. According to the survey, 37% of parents of a child 5 to 11 and 28% of parents of a child 12 to 17 say they will not get them vaccinated against COVID-19. Parents' response varied significantly when broken down by partisanship and vaccination status. Just 21% of Democrat-leaning parents said they would not vaccinate their young children, compared with 64% of Republican-leaning parents. The survey found 27% of vaccinated parents said they would not vaccinate their child, compared with 64% of unvaccinated parents. About 300,000 children under 5 have received at least one COVID-19 shot, the White House says. More than 8 in 10 parents of unvaccinated young children said they were concerned about serious side effects and about unknown long-term effects. Majorities of vaccinated parents of unvaccinated children also had these concerns with side effects. While concerns about long-term effects and side effects were common across demographic lines, white parents reported fewer logistical concerns around vaccinating their young children. More than 4 in 10 black parents expressed concern over taking off time for vaccination, and 45% of Hispanic parents said they were concerned about getting their child vaccinated from a trusted provider. The survey data also shows room for improvement on vaccine education and a possible opportunity to get unvaccinated children vaccinated. More than half of parents of young children who said they felt their government information around vaccinating their child was confusing. Nearly 40% of parents of unvaccinated children said they did not have enough information on where to find a vaccine. Across income groups, a majority of parents with household incomes of at least $90,000 said they think the information from federal health agencies about vaccinating children under 5 is clear, while majorities of those with lower incomes say it's confusing, the authors said. One-time vaccination clinics were popular for adult vaccinations, but many parents of unvaccinated children are considering vaccination alongside regular medical appointments. Most parents of children under 5 newly eligible for the vaccine say they have not spoken to their pediatrician or other healthcare providers about the vaccine for their child. And most of those parents say they will have that discussion at their child's next visit. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommends that infants and young children see a physician at 6 months, 9 months, 12 months, 15 months, 18 months, 24 months, 30 months, 3 years, and 4 years old. Yes, well, so nationally, there was a little blip, you know, this few hundred thousand parents who got their youngest children vaccinated. But then that's dropped about half that amount since then and is maintained at a really low level. So it looks like it's going to take many, many months before we get vaccination rates up anywhere near where they are with other child age groups, of which are already at fairly low vaccination rates. Okay, and we're doing a little more deeper dive into that. This is directly from the Kaiser Family Foundation. Their COVID-19 vaccine monitor. Adding to the reluctance of some parents to vaccinate their young children, a slight majority, 53% of parents of the youngest children, view the vaccine as a bigger risk to their child's health than getting infected with COVID-19. The share saying the vaccine is a bigger risk rises to 73% among Republican and Republican-leaning parents, 71% among parents who are unvaccinated themselves, and 67% among parents whose child has previously tested positive for COVID-19. With breakthrough infections and reinfections growing more common with the Omicron BA4 and BA5 subvariants, many parents are also concerned about the efficacy of the vaccines. 7 in 10 parents are very or somewhat concerned that the vaccine will not protect their young child from getting sick from COVID-19, including majorities of both vaccinated, 71%, and unvaccinated, 69%. Parents of unvaccinated kids. Yeah, so it's kind of interesting that people, they're concerned about efficacy, but there's really two things to look at. One, of course, is can you prevent infection completely, which with the new variants, that has proven problematic, that it busts through. These so-called breakthrough infections are not uncommon at all. People getting, you know, infected for a second, third, fourth time, regardless of their vaccination status. So the new variants are very good at that. But also, each additional dose or each additional infection with COVID-19 that you get, every time you're exposed to it through vaccine or through the actual virus, it reduces your chance of getting serious disease for the next potential bout. And so this is the severe outcomes that are talked about that are most desirable to avoid. And while in absolute numbers, each additional booster, for instance, doesn't make a huge change in absolute numbers, it is actually very effective at reducing whatever remaining risks that you have. So you take like a 50-year-old, they might have a moderate risk of being vaccinated a couple times and have a booster or two. But for each additional booster, it actually does drastically reduce that remaining bit of risk that you have. So on an absolute scale, the numbers are not that huge, but on a relative scale, it's actually very efficacious, each additional booster that you get. And of course, you can do it the hard way just by getting COVID. But of course, that's what we're trying to avoid in the first place, is exposure to COVID prior to having good immunological status, preferably through vaccines. Okay, one more COVID-19 story, and this one's sort of one about how long COVID really sucks, and one of the things that can really affect quality of life a lot. This is from Medical Express. At least 27 million COVID patients may have long-term smell and taste problems. About 5% of adults may develop long-lasting changes in their sense of smell or taste after COVID-19 infection, suggests research published in the British Medical Journal. Given the huge impact that loss of smell and taste can have on quality of life and general health, this could contribute to the rising burden of COVID, warned the researchers. Change in the sense of smell and taste is common in patients with COVID-19, with 40 to 50% of people on average reporting these symptoms globally. But little is known about the clinical course of these symptoms or how many patients develop persistent problems. The researchers found that smell loss may persist in 5.6% of patients, while 4.4% may not recover their sense of taste. At 30 days after initial infection, only 74% of patients reported smell recovery, and 79% of patients reported taste recovery. Recovery rates increase with each passing month, reaching a peak of 96% for smell and 98% for taste after 6 months. Okay, just want to pause for a minute there and unpack some of those numbers. So this, of course, is talking about people who've had a COVID infection. So 5.6% of them have some persistent taste or smell loss, 4 to 6%. It's a little more for smell loss than it is for taste. But that means that, you know, for getting infection, that means for all the infections, in fact, that most of the population has had at least one viral infection, getting up there pretty high, getting pretty near to 100%. Maybe it's 85%. It's hard to know for sure, but the vast majority of people have actually been infected in the country. So if somebody has a 5% chance, and it's almost a complete population, that means you could end up having several percent of people who have very persistent smell or taste loss, which really stinks, no pun intended. Okay, women were less likely to recover their sense of smell and taste than men. While patients with greater initial severity of smell loss and those with nasal congestion were less likely to recover their sense of smell. Health systems are unprepared for the scale of the challenge, warn experts in a linked editorial. They say health leaders, policymakers, and research funders should realize the extraordinary importance of good chemosensory function for the well-being of humans. So, another reason to just try to avoid COVID is long COVID, and particularly this kind of insidious long-term side effect that you could have of no smell or taste. And actually, to kind of add to that too, some people have changes in smell and taste where you keep smelling really odorous things, not pleasant smells, which could be another annoying loss in one's life. Okay, well, time for the local COVID-19 update for Lucas County. Lucas County, by the CDC's community indicator, is listed as medium level, and this is due to hospitalizations. Our so-called low rate of infections, which means reported infections, which are very low, puts us down in the medium. But the hospitalizations are getting to the point where that alone may bump us into the high. So we're at 17.8 per 100,000 people per week. And if we get to 20, that'll bump us into the high community category. So hospital admissions are rising in Lucas County. And I actually think this was kind of there was a lot of argument, of course, about how the CDC changed those community categories. But with the number of cases that are being reported is so low compared to the actual number, it kind of hamstrings that. It drives it artificially down into a lower medium category when actually you have a lot more actual infection. But of course, it's hard to hide hospitalizations, something that's serious enough that you need a hospitalization. So the hospitalization date is probably a lot more accurate, although it's delayed. It's not as timely, real-time way to survey the COVID-19 epidemic, but it may be one of the best that we have right at the moment. Okay, well, given that caveat, the Lucas County average daily number of cases over the last couple of weeks has risen a bit from 94 a couple of weeks ago. I didn't have a show last week. I had a greatest hit show up to 104. But I'm not even reporting that. It takes more time to talk about the caveats than we really get from the data. So I'll have to decide whether anyone just wants to stop reporting on that. But that's going up modestly. Testing positivity rates are still very high, about 14.7% in Lucas County. Even higher, though, in Ohio at 20+% test positivity and about 18% nationally, which is holding relatively steady at crappy. Okay, nursing homes, as I said in the last show, I'm not sure how this data is getting less and less reliable, but it looks like we had a similar amount that we had from a couple weeks ago, 46 active cases, 24 residents and 22 staff in the most recent week. And we did have one more death among long-term care facility nursing home residents since the last reporting. Okay, well, nationally, hospitalizations and ICU patients in the U.S. are still increasing. So it's not anywhere near the rapid rise that we've seen before, but it's a slow, steady increase that we've seen over months. Deaths nationally are starting to catch up, and they're at an average of over 435 per day, And that would be over $150,000 a year if you annualize that. If that continued over an entire year, that $435,000 would turn into $150,000 plus deaths. And that's a scary amount, a level that I would certainly consider unacceptable. We can do better. Okay, well, COVID-19 has been tough times for everybody, and public health workers have taken it on the chin as well. This from Axios. 1 in 5 Americans okay with threatening health officials. 1 in 5 Americans thought it was acceptable to threaten or harass public health officials over pandemic business closures as of last summer, research in JAMA Open Network shows. Why it matters. The antagonism extended beyond science doubters and people hurting from the effects of COVID-19 to higher earners, political independents, and those with more education. The Johns Hopkins survey found the percentage of adults believing that threatening public health officials was justified rose from 15% to 21% from November 2020 to the summer of 2021. The biggest increases were among respondents who were male, identified as Hispanic, and who were Republicans. There were also increases among those earning over $35,000 a year. Most respondents who thought attacks on public health officials were justified felt the same way about attacks on politicians, possibly reflecting the view that health officials make inherently political decisions, the researchers said. The big picture, the targeting of public health workers has exacerbated the stress and anxiety among medical workers. Surveys showed more than half of public health workers experienced at least one adverse mental health condition in the spring of 2021, and more than half reported at least one post-traumatic stress disorder symptom between September 2021 and January 2022. And I would add an even bigger picture, going back to the fact that this is very similar to, you know, feeling the same way on these attacks on politicians, besides just politicizing public health a lot. I think it might speak to kind of a canary in the coal mine about political violence, and that they're, unfortunately, when you have 1/5 of the population that seems open to political violence, that can be very dangerous. Okay, well, you know, public health and public health workers do a lot of kind of boring things, but I'd just like to lift up one of the things kind of on the cutting edge, because public health is a long game, and you have to throw a wide net in order to prevent disease and disability, morbidity in a population. So here's a story from MedPage today. CDC says bacteria causing deadly disease found in U.S. soil for first time. The CDC has detected Burkholderia pseudomallei, a bacteria that can cause the rare and sometimes deadly melioidosis disease. They found this in environmental samples along the Gulf Coast region. This marks the first time that this bacteria has been found on U.S. soil, but it's likely the bacteria has been present since at least 2020, and modeling data suggests the area is well-suited for continued growth, the agency warned. Once well-established in soil, the bacteria cannot feasibly be removed. So, as just an editorial note, this is a climate change story as well. As our world's climate changes, you're going to see disease parameters that are based on environmental conditions change over time. So what is this? Melioidosis has a wide range of nonspecific symptoms like fever, joint pain, and headaches, and can cause conditions that include pneumonia, abscess formation, or blood infections, the agency noted in a statement. The bacteria has historically been found in tropical and subtropical areas such as South and Southeast Asia and Northern Australia and parts of Central and South America and Puerto Rico. Worldwide, case fatality rates with the disease range from 10 to 50%, but cases have been too few in the U.S., about a dozen per year for accurate numbers. So worldwide, anything that has 10 to 50% fatality rate anywhere in the world is not something to be ignored. It is quite possible that climate changes are letting the pathogen find a new niche for survival in the soil, and instead of being deep down from the surface, the pathogen is now on the surface and the individual can get infected with it. The CDC said people living along the Gulf Coast of Mississippi with health conditions placing them at high risk for poor outcomes from melioidosis, for example, heavy drinkers, people with diabetes or chronic kidney disease or lung disease, should take precautions such as avoiding contact with soil or muddy waters, especially after heavy rains. You heard it here. Although I don't know how far, I don't think our signal reaches to Mississippi, but online that may be the case. And you are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's move to a much bigger new-to-USA disease, this from CNN. Testing is crucial to getting monkeypox under control, but there's a shocking lack of demand. Testing for monkeypox, a crucial part of containing the growing outbreak, has gotten off to a sluggish start at the five commercial laboratories that are doing nearly all the nation's testing. Mayo Clinic Laboratories, for example, has the capacity to process 1,000 monkeypox samples a week, but has received only 45 specimens from doctors since starting monkeypox testing July 11th. Another of the labs, Aegis Sciences Corporation, can do 5,000 tests per week, but has received zero samples over the past 2 weeks. At LabCorp, one of the largest commercial labs in the U.S., uptake has been higher but still, quote, extremely low, according to Dr. Brian Cavanaugh, the lab's president of diagnostics. Monkeypox is spreading faster than the data about it, hindering mitigation efforts. These numbers are shocking, said Dr. Peter Chin Hong, a member of the California Department of Public Health's Monkeypox Virus Scientific Advisory Committee. Dr. Anthony Fauci, President Biden's chief medical officer, described testing as a pillar of the government's monkeypox response. He and other officials, health officials, have repeatedly assured the American that there's high capacity to handle testing, with labs capable of processing 80,000 specimens per week. Most of that capacity, 70,000 specimens, is in private labs. Testing is a major part of the monkeypox contaminant effort for two reasons. It's the first step to identifying and isolating patients, and it gives public health officials an idea of the scope of the outbreak and which geographic areas need the most resources. Well, this is a basic lesson in public health that, you know, having a drug doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get to people. Having immunizations on the shelf doesn't necessarily mean it's going to get into people's arms. And the same is with testing. You can have testing capacity, but you don't have the rest. If you don't have the rest of things lined up in your society and your public health infrastructure, isn't necessarily going to happen. Okay, back to the story. Without testing, you're flying blind, said Dr. William Maurice, chair of the board of directors of the American Clinical Laboratory Association and president of Mayo's lab. The biggest concern is that you're not going to identify cases, and monkeypox could become an endemic illness in this country. That's something we really have to worry about. Doctors say search for monkeypox cases needs to look beyond men who have sex with men. Experts say education is only one reason for the slow adoption of testing. For another, some people who have monkeypox symptoms may not seek care for fear of being stigmatized. They might think, I'm going to identify myself as someone who is frowned on in society. I have sex with men, I have multiple sex partners, or I didn't use protection. That's what having monkeypox says now, and you can imagine people don't want to say all that, said Chin Hong, an infectious disease expert at UC San Francisco School of Medicine, who has treated people with monkeypox. Also, many members of the LGBTQ community are accustomed to getting care from sexual health clinics, which are now overwhelmed treating monkeypox patients as well as their regular caseloads, according to David Harvey, executive director of the National Coalition of STD Directors, which represents public and private sexual health clinics and programs. He said that about half of the clinics in his organization don't send specimens to private labs because it's too expensive to hire staff to manage the paperwork, which might help explain why the volume of monkeypox tests at private labs has been so low. It's very frustrating to us in the sexually transmitted infection field to hear information coming from the White House and the CDC about testing capacity and access to vaccines when what doesn't get discussed is all the implementation issues within our everyday clinic, Harvey said. Last Monday, more than 100 members of Congress wrote a letter to the Biden administration urging additional funding for sexual health clinics to improve the monkeypox response effort. As monkeypox cases continue to rise, states and communities are heavily relying on health clinics' expertise in disease detection, contact tracing, symptom monitoring, and community education, as well as their community connections, to help slow the spread of the virus, the letter said. So another classic example of some basic public health principles. You need to invest in the boring infrastructure, so when stuff comes along, you have some capacity to deal with it. And what happens now, often in public health, typically in public health, is when you get something new added on top, it means you have to pull resources from someplace else. So something else that's probably just about as important, maybe as important, who knows, maybe even more important, has to go to the new emerging health concern. But if you think we have it bad here, this from Associated Press. Africa's alone in monkeypox deaths but has no vaccine doses. Africa still does not have a single dose of the monkeypox vaccine, even though it's the only continent to have documented deaths from the disease that's newly declared a global emergency, its public health agency announced last Thursday. And I would note that in the intervening days, there have been, I think it was at least three deaths that have been reported from outside of Africa. Let us get vaccines onto the continent, the acting head of the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Ahmed Ogwell, said in a weekly media briefing. He described a situation where the African continent of 1.3 billion people is again being left behind in access to doses, an uncomfortable echo of the COVID-19 pandemic. Less than a week ago, the World Health Organization declared monkeypox an extraordinary situation that qualifies as a global health emergency. Although monkeypox has been established in parts of Central and West Africa for decades, it was not known to spark large outbreaks beyond the continent or to spread widely among people until May, when authorities detected dozens of epidemics in Europe, North America, and elsewhere. Now the global race is on to obtain monkeypox vaccine doses. The European Commission, the European Union's executive arm, has secured the purchase of 160,000 doses of vaccine for the disease. Last Wednesday, U.S. health regulators said nearly 800,000 doses of the monkeypox vaccine will soon be available for distribution after what they described as weeks of delays. Even doses of the smallpox vaccine, which has shown effectiveness against monkeypox, are not available in Africa, Ogwell said. The solution needs to be global in nature, he said, in a warning to the international community. If we're not safe, the rest of the world is not safe. The COVID-19 pandemic and the global hoarding of vaccine doses were a jolt to African leaders, who quickly joined together in an unprecedented effort to obtain doses and establish the production of more vaccines on the continent. Now, to their dismay, the monkeypox outbreak is again showing how the world's richer countries hurry to protect their own people first. And I might add, soon after that, get amnesia about it all. Okay, well, let's switch it up and do a little better story. This one's also in an African nation. So we can see that success is possible with the proper investments and initiatives. This from Medical Express. Botswana hits historic UN goal against HIV. Botswana has become the second nation in the world after Eswatini to reach a landmark UN goal towards eradicating AIDS, researchers said last Wednesday, in what health experts hailed as stellar results. The country has met the so-called 95-95-95 target in HIV diagnosis, treatment, and viral suppression several years early, according to a study published ahead of a global conference on the disease. About 1 in 5 people in Botswana live with the virus, yikes. One of the highest rates in the world, according to the UN AIDS agency. The agency wanted 95% of HIV-positive people to know their status, 95% of those diagnosed on medication, and 95% of those under treatment to show signs that the virus has been suppressed in their blood by 2025. But the study led by Botswana Health Ministry found the country had already met or surpassed all three thresholds with a 95-98-98 score. The global average in 2020 was 84-87-90. Way to go, Botswana. The country is well positioned to end its HIV epidemic by 2030. To put it simply, these are really stellar results. We have translated a hopeless situation into a situation where there's now hope. Now both the government and people on medication can look forward to Botswana one day becoming an AIDS-free country. That was a far cry from when he started working on the disease 2 decades ago, and it seemed the nation was facing extinction due to a high number of infections. UN AIDS Deputy Executive Director Matthew Cavanaugh said Botswana's progress was down to a series of factors, including government investment and the rapid adoption of self-testing. In 2002, Botswana became the first African country to offer free antiretroviral drugs, which helped contain the virus and prevent it from infecting others. In 2019, the country of 2.3 million people decriminalized same-sex relationships, something that Cavanaugh says has helped to get more and more people into care. It's not an easy feat, but what it shows is it is doable with investment and political commitment, as well as communities working to deliver the needed services. Globally, about 38 million people, including almost 2 million children, were living with HIV in 2020, and more than 600,000 die from AIDS-related illnesses each year, according to UNAIDS. Okay, well, let's return to the U.S. and look at a story that sort of illustrates the mess that is our healthcare system. This from Kaiser Health News. Even well-intended laws can't protect us from inaccurate provider directories. If you have medical insurance, chances are you've been utterly exasperated at some point while trying to find an available doctor or mental health practitioner in your health plan's network. It goes like this. You find multiple providers in the plan's directory, and you call them. All of them. Alas, the number is wrong, or the doctor has moved, or retired, or isn't accepting new patients, or the next available appointment is 3 months away. Or perhaps the provider simply is not in your network. Despite a spate of state and federal regulations that require more accurate health plan directories, they can still contain numerous errors and are often maddeningly outdated. Flawed directories not only impede our ability to get care, but also signal that health insurers aren't meeting requirements to provide timely care, even if they tell regulators they are. Worse, patients who rely on erroneous directory information can end up facing inflated bills from doctors or hospitals that turn out to be outside their network. In 2016, California implemented a law to regulate the accuracy of provider directories. The state was trying to address long-standing problems, illustrated by an embarrassing debacle in 2014 when Covered California, the insurance marketplace that the state formed after the passage of the Affordable Care Act, was forced to pull its error-riddled directory within its first year. Also in 2016, the Federal Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services demanded more accurate directories for Medicare Advantage health plans and policies sold through the federal ACA marketplace. And the Federal No Surprises Act, which took effect this year, extends similar rules to employer-based and individual health plans. Unfortunately, inaccurate directories continue to plague our healthcare system. A study published in June in the Journal of Health Politics, Policy, and Law analyzed data from the California Department of Managed Healthcare on directory accuracy and timely access to care. It found that in the best case, consumers could get timely appointments and urgent cases with just 54% of the doctors listed in a directory. In the worst case, 28%. For general appointments, the best case was 64%, in the worst case, 35%. A key takeaway the authors write is that even progressive and pro-consumer legislation and regulations have effectively failed to offer substantial protection for consumers. Now, of course, if we had a single-payer, unified national healthcare system, your provider network would be the entire country. Boy, would that simplify things.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Well, folks, that was part one of a trifecta of parody PSAs. Here's the other two.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming. And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, that was the first three parody PSAs in a row, and you were here to witness it. Well, next up, we have a couple stories about another area, two areas that America excels at: opioid addiction and gun violence. First up from Medical Express, coming wave of opioid overdoses, quote, will be worse than it has ever been before. Over the past 21 years of opioid overdose deaths, from prescription drugs to heroin to synthetic and semi-synthetic opioids such as fentanyl, geography has played a role in where opioid-involved overdose deaths have occurred, reports a new Northwestern Medicine study. But the coming wave will not discriminate between rural and urban areas, the study findings suggest. Every type of county, from the most rural to the most urban, is predicted to see dramatic increases in deaths from opioid-involved overdoses. The reason opioid overdoses have reached historical highs comes from combining synthetic opioids with stimulants such as cocaine and methamphetamines, a lethal cocktail that is hard to reverse during an overdose. I'm sounding the alarm because for the first time there is a convergence and escalation of acceleration rates for every type of rural and urban county, said author Lori Post, director of the Center for Health Policy and Economics at Northwestern University School of Medicine. Not only is the death rate from an opioid at an all-time high, but the acceleration of the death rate signals explosive exponential growth that is even larger than an already historic high. We have the highest escalation rate for the first time in America, and this fourth wave will be worse than it's ever been before, Post said. It's going to mean mass death. And on to the front of gun violence, this from MedPage Today. How many high schoolers are packing heat? Certain high school age students, especially those with adverse life experiences, were more likely to report carrying guns for non-recreational purposes in a CDC survey. The practice was significantly more likely among those who had a history of violence-related experiences, suicidal ideation or attempts, or substance use. It was also more common among boys, 26%, and girls, 11%, who had been injured or threatened with a weapon on school property. Gun carrying occurred at the highest frequency in three racial ethnic groups: non-Hispanic Black at 10.6%, Hispanic 7.2%, and non-Hispanic White at 6.1%. Social and structural conditions, for instance, concentrated poverty, high crime rates, and economic or residential instability, were associated with youth violence and contribute to inequities in violence among racial and ethnic minority populations. Further, youths who have experienced violence, discrimination, or racism might feel an increased need for protection, might be unwilling or unable to rely on law enforcement, and might carry a gun for self-protection. From 2019 to 2020, the rate of firearm-related deaths among children and teenagers aged 1 to 19 increased by 14%, causing it to become the leading cause of death in that age group. The phenomenon is largely driven by a one-third overall increase in the rate of firearm-related homicides during this time frame. Okay, well, next up, I want to do something that covers an area that's a love of mine in public health, and that's nutrition, but also a pet peeve of mine, which is some supplements. This from Medical Express. Study casts more doubt on use of high-dose vitamin D pills. And I'll just add, I normally don't cover stories that have no effect, but because vitamin D has been hyped up so much, and I predicted this years ago, that vitamin D would not pan out to the miracle cure all for just about anything that people were and still are saying. And that wasn't out of nowhere. That's based on a lot of experience. There's been so much disappointment in recent decades about experimental tests trying to study whether supplements actually are helpful or not. Okay, well, let's get back to the story. More research suggests it's time to abandon the craze over vitamin D. Taking high doses of the sunshine vitamin doesn't reduce the risk of broken bones in generally healthy older Americans, researchers reported. It's the latest in a string of disappointments about a nutrient once hoped to have wide-ranging protective effects. That same study of nearly 26,000 people already had found that popping lots of vitamin D pills didn't prevent heart disease, cancer, or memory loss either. And while getting enough vitamin D is important for strong bones, more is not better, said Dr. Merrill Leboff of Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital, the study's lead author. An estimated third of Americans 60 and older takes the supplements, and more than 10 million blood tests for vitamin D levels are performed annually, despite years of controversy over whether the average older adult needs either. The newest findings, added to other trials with similar results, should end that debate, wrote Dr. Stephen Cummings of California Pacific Medical Center and Clifford Rosen of Maine Medical Center Research Institute in a commentary in the medical journal. People should stop taking vitamin D supplements to prevent major diseases, and doctors should stop the routine screenings that fuel concern, the pair concluded. They weren't involved in the latest study. The supplements didn't reduce the risk of broken hips or other bones, Leboff reported in the New England Journal of Medicine. While vitamin D and calcium work best together, she said even the 20% of study participants who also took a calcium supplement did not benefit. Nor did the small number of study participants who had low blood levels of vitamin D. Overall, these findings overturn dogma and cast doubt on the value of routine screening for vitamin D blood levels and blanket recommendations for supplementation. Spending time outdoors, being physically active, and having a heart-healthy diet will lead to greater gains in health. Okay, well, the next story on supplementation sort of proves that there's an exception to every rule, this from Medical Express. First trial to prove a diet supplement can prevent hereditary cancer. A trial in people with high hereditary risk of wide range of cancers has shown a major preventive effect from resistant starch found in a wide range of foods such as oats, breakfast cereal, cooked and cooled pasta or rice, peas and beans, and slightly green bananas. An international trial involving almost 1,000 patients with Lynch syndrome from around the world and revealed that a regular dose of resistant starch, also known as fermentable fiber, taken for an average of 2 years, did not affect cancers in the bowel but did reduce cancers in other parts of the body by more than half. This effect was particularly pronounced for upper gastrointestinal cancers, including esophageal, gastric, biliary tract, pancreatic, and duodenum cancers. The astonishing effect was seen to last for 10 years after stopping taking the supplement. Resistant starch can be taken as a powder supplement and is found naturally in peas, beans, oats, and other starchy foods. The dose used in this trial is equivalent to eating a daily banana, that is before they become too ripe and soft. The starch in bananas resists breakdown and reaches the bowel where it can change the type of bacteria that live there. So this is a very interesting study because they picked a study a population that is unusual, that has a really high hereditary risk for a wide range of cancers. And this allows a smaller sample size to measure effects of a particular intervention, in this case, supplements with resistant starch. So very good study. Also, it does just point to just regular kind of nutrition. You don't have to take this in a pill or anything. Resistant starch is present in a lot of foods. And for those of you practicing whole food plant-based diets, you'll find it's not too hard to fit in a decent amount of resistant starch. They said here, again, found in a wide range of foods such as oats, breakfast cereal, cooked and cooled pasta or rice, peas and beans, and slightly green bananas. Now, the cooked and cooled pasta and rice is an interesting one because this is actually a big tip of the hat to leftovers. Because if you cook something that has a lot of starch, like pasta or rice, and you cool it, it forms this resistant starch. Now, you get the most resistant starch if you eat it cold later. And I'm not saying eat all cold leftovers, but one thing you can do is eat things like, you know, cold potato or pasta salad dishes, great thing in the summer to do, and you get a lot of resistant starch. Now, you can heat up your leftovers again, and you lose a lot of the resistant starch, but each time you cool it and reheat it, you're going to produce a little bit more of this starch. It's sort of a reversible chemical reaction, but it's not completely reversible. So, you know, go leftovers. Your gut microbiome will thank you. Those bacteria can be our friends. Okay, well, now it's time for section bonus articles. A carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I have reported on in this episode. I'll give the link at the end of the list. Well, we have 16 bonus articles this week. First up, number one, summer boosters for people under 50 shelved in favor of updated boosters in the fall. So there's been this debate about whether to get more shots in arms with the specific types of vaccines we have now or do an updated one that incorporates the later Omicron subvariants, which I frankly think is a better call. I think this is probably the right thing to do with limited resources. And also the fall would be running into flu season, so that's good timing. Okay, two, their medications cause pregnancy issues. Post-Row, that could be dangerous. People with disabilities are considering the risks of pregnancy and their essential medications. So people with disabilities often have medications that can cause an abortion. So if they get pregnant, intentionally, unintentionally, they have to manage that. And of course, you're living in a state that doesn't allow abortion. It could be trouble. And these are essential medications that many people with disabilities rely upon. Three, related to that, an opinion piece, leave my disability out of your anti-abortion propaganda. Four, why exceptions for the life of the mother have disappeared? The absence of these exemptions is a sign of anti-abortion right movement's distrust of women and the medical establishment. And five, a nearly century-old maternity home for teens in the South makes plans for expansion. So for those of us that are old enough to remember homes for unwed mothers, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, particularly when, you know, young women would go off and visit their aunt for the summer or, you know, take care of a sick relative or something, you know, have a baby and then come back. Now, this isn't nearly as needed now, but the fact, society's changed a lot in a lot of different ways, but particularly in the South, where a lot of young women, particularly Black women, are going to have a difficult time with unplanned, unwanted pregnancies, and they need some support, and this is one way to do it. So a little bit of a retro programming for the U.S. Six, the war on drugs has a warning for post-Roe America. Criminalizing abortion will increase harm while failing to stop the behavior it is intended to reduce. Yeah, that's like losing on all fronts. The criminalization is obviously pretty messy to begin with, but the fact is that if you can't even stop what you're intending to reduce, then causing the harm, of course, cannot be justified. If you want to think about probably the perfect example in U.S. history for this, it would be prohibition. Caused a lot of trouble. A lot of criminal syndicates arose, which is also true with the drug trade today is that largely what we create with the war on drugs is very expensive, limited drug supplies, limited in the sense that it's legally precarious for cartels to get drugs into the country, so it raises the cost. And I'm not talking just dollars, I'm talking socially. But it doesn't, interdiction doesn't provide enough decrease in the drug supply for people to basically not get whatever drugs they want. So it's better to, rather than criminalizing, you know, having a war on drugs or criminalizing abortion, just providing non-judgmental health care. And that's a lead up to article number 7 in the bonus article section. Biden's drug czar is leading the charge for a harm reduction approach. In regard to drug use, there's a lot of places around the country have set up like safe use centers and needle exchange programs and this type of thing so that that drug users can reduce harms of their drug use. And the thing important to understand about addiction is it isn't necessarily a lifelong problem. So people can recover, but you want people to get on the other side of that. And particularly when you're talking about like the story I reported earlier in this show about the rise of these synthetic opioids that are being mixed with like cocaine and methamphetamines and other opioids, it's very dangerous. So the fact is most drug users will come out the other side, but you want as many as possible in as good condition as possible. So you have to be non-judgmental, a little bit patient, and apply scientific principles. Okay, well, next up, story number 8, how polio crept back into the U.S. Yes, we had the first case of polio in the U.S. recently, and this story will give you the background of how that happened. Kind of the short form is that it has to do with a shot full of holes public health infrastructure. And then this next one, number 9 in the bonus stories, what to know about polio, a disease once again vying for attention. I actually learned some interesting things I'd never heard about polio, so it's a good backgrounder for polio. And bonus story number 10, this is a follow-up for a story I did a few weeks ago. What happened to the monkeypox name change? The World Health Organization, there's this, you know, committee that is charged with that. And the short story is that it's a lot more complicated than you think to change a name. They need to come up with a whole taxonomy, a whole way of doing it. So that's probably going to take a while. It's probably in the pipeline, but it might be quite a while. Story number 11. Encouraged by right-wing doctor groups, desperate patients turn to disproven ivermectin for long COVID. Now, besides just being bad medicine and bad public health, this is a very good read for understanding the ongoing grifts in medicine and alternative medicine, where you've got people charging exorbitant fees and preying on people's insecurities and desperation to make money. That's also something America's pretty good at. Number 12, studies throw cold water on COVID lab leak theory. Researchers say new analysis points to Wuhan market as early epicenter. Now that's been the most likely possibility for some time, but the lab leak theory was still a possibility as being held out there. But I must say, reading through this and having followed this over the recent years as this has developed, this is pretty strong evidence that that the pandemic that we're living today came through the Wuhan market. Story number 13, hospices have become big business for private equity firms, raising concerns about end-of-life care. So hospices used to almost be completely nonprofits. Now that's switching, and then that's bad enough, for-profit versus nonprofit. But then when you throw in private equity firms, they kick into high gear about raising money rather than providing care. And even for people that are end of life, there is a lot of quality care. There's a big difference between quality care and low quality care. So let's get rid of the cancer of private profit in healthcare. Story number 14, value-based payment has produced little value. It needs a timeout. This is just another story of kind of tinkering at the edges with our healthcare system. We need big change, healthcare for all. 15, black life expectancy in the southern U.S. is affected by the legacy of slavery. another good analysis of the long, far-reaching effects of racism and slavery in U.S. culture. And lastly, but not least, public health workers still face PTSD and other mental health problems. Well, you can read all these stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some